Welcome to Fireside Markets, your audio home for thoughtful and insightful discussions of financial markets, investment strategies, economics, retirement, and more. Fireside Markets is hosted by James Osborne, president of Basin Asset Management, a Colorado registered investment advisor.
Good morning, this is James Osborne, and you're listening to Fireside Markets, a project of Basin Asset Management. Thank you for joining us. Today's guest is Ben Carlson. Ben blogs at A Wealth of Common Sense, which is awealthofcommonsense.com, and is on Twitter at awealthofcs. Ben is a Yahoo Finance contributor as well, and professionally an analyst and on a portfolio management team for a charitable endowment. Ben, welcome to Fireside Markets.
Thanks for having me, James.
Absolutely. Our topic for today is fixing the 401k and retirement savings in the United States. Ben and I have separately and together shared some thoughts about the 401k landscape and what works, what doesn't work, what might be better. Ben, why don't you first give a little bit of background about what you do professionally, and then we'll kind of chat more about the 401k landscape as it stands today.
Sure. Yes, I'm actually on the institutional side of portfolio management. So I work for an organization and I help manage their portfolio. So I have a client of one, basically. But working in the investment business, family and friends, and now people on the internet, since I write for the blog, are constantly asking questions, what should they do? And invariably it comes down to their retirement plan, because that's the easiest way for people to save. And so I get questions and scenarios and concerns on, you know, retirement plans all the time. So I do think about this stuff a lot, and I write about it a lot on my blog. And just from my small sample size of talking to people, I get the sense that there could be a lot of things that could be fixed or changed that could make it a lot easier for people to save for retirement.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, the general landscape of the 401k, the tax code that allowed for 401k plans was theoretically designed to be a supplemental retirement savings vehicle. And of course the landscape changed and the nature of unintended consequences arose, and essentially corporations discovered that they could offset some future liability by putting the burden of retirement savings onto the employee. Now, I'm not here to get into any kind of moral debate about if that's right or proper. The reality is that the risk of retirement savings and that future liability has to be borne somewhere if people do in fact want to retire. And so today we have an environment where people are responsible for their future well-being. Now, I'll back up and say this idea that 50 years ago everyone had a pension is incorrect. At best, there may have been maybe 50% of people who worked in the private sector who had access to a pension for retirement. But nevertheless, that number has declined dramatically. Personally, I see a number of issues that are troubling about the current 401k landscape. The one is we have very low participation and savings rates. The Center for Retirement Research, which is an independent body, analyzed and came up with a number that we are on track for a $6.6 trillion shortfall in retirement savings. Now, I'm not entirely sure what to do with that number, but the reality is that the first problem we need to solve is involvement. Average deferrals being somewhere in the 5-7% range is insufficient for retirement savings. Ben, what do we do about this?
Yeah, I think first of all, we just have to make it easier for people to save. And again, not everyone has a workplace retirement plan, and even the people that do have one aren't saving in it. So I think if you make things easy for people, they'll do it. If you make it hard, it's really hard for people to change their behavior. So I like the automatic opt-in. I think Again, like you say, the first problem is just getting people to save. It's not, people worry all the time about their investment choices and their funds, and that is important. But the first step, people actually have to have the money set aside to invest in the first place. And yeah, so I think that the Save More for Tomorrow by Richard Thaler, that idea is a really good one, just to get people to bump up how much they save every year. So they, you know, you make the decision ahead of time, I'm going to save 1% more, 2% more next year. And you just make it automatic. So again, you don't have to make that conscious decision every single time. And I think for those that don't have a workplace retirement plan, I think we need to make it easier for them to save too. And we can get into this later if you want, I'm sure, but the IRA, I think we need to make it easier for people to save in that respect too.
Yeah. So you identified two problems that I'd like to break apart and get into a little deeper here. The first is not everyone has a workplace retirement plan. And, you know, professionally, I consult and advise on a number of small business 401k plans. And my experience in that space has been the desire to establish a workplace retirement plan for a small business owner, for most of them is real, but they often find a large hurdle from an administrative cost standpoint and just the headache of establishing and managing a 401k plan. Additionally, for most small business owners, setting up a 401k plan means taking on a fiduciary liability to their employees and their plan participants. And a lot of small business owners simply don't want to deal with that. As we enter a landscape where we're questioning if health insurance ought to be tied to one's employment, I would raise the same question about retirement savings. Why are we in a position where, for most people, their retirement savings is offered through their employer, or their ability to save the most for retirement, essentially for everyone, is offered through their employer? And do we have alternatives to that? So do you have any thoughts on that? Are there alternative structures we should be looking at?
Yeah, well, and I agree with you on the small business front, because those are the people that I hear from the most that are having the biggest issues. And it's through no fault of their own, because these people aren't trained to know what to look for when they're doing this. But yeah, again, like you said, it's a burdensome cost to them, and it's difficult for them to find something that they can use that can scale, because, you know, if they have 10, 20, 30 employees, they're going to be paying way more than a company that has thousands of employees. And so, right, it almost seems like it's not fair to them, because their employees are going to be taking most of those costs, basically, and most of the time people don't even know about it. So
right.
There needs to be a way for employees at small businesses to somehow come together and pool things together so they can get those economies of scale that larger companies are able to offer.
Yeah, it's one thing for Johnson & Johnson to be able to establish a 401k plan at a narrow marginal cost to their employees. But as you said, for a small business with maybe 20 employees, it can be quite burdensome because there's no scale there. And if you add on top of that the fact that most of these small businesses are unaware of the true cost of the plan, and certainly the participants in the 401k plan are unaware of those costs, it becomes a very expensive proposition. There's a lot of informational asymmetry between the providers of 401k plan services and the end user of the 401k. Like you, I would like to see a situation where small business owners could pool together or be part of some larger group and have access to the plan if we must be in a situation where the retirement plan is still driven by the employer.
Right.
One question that comes to mind for me in this scenario is, why are limits for an IRA annual contribution so much lower than a 401k?
Yes, I have to agree there. And yeah, and it's, you know, maybe what, 30% of the limit. And one of the big problems too with the 401k is, even though the limit's higher and And it really is easier for people because the money just comes right out of their paycheck. They have the upfront tax advantage, and it's just much simpler for them. But the problem becomes when people change jobs, which, you know, younger people now are changing jobs 10 to 12 times before the end of their career now. Fidelity had a study out a couple weeks ago where they said that people between the ages of 25 and 49, 40% of them are taking out all or partial of their 401k, cashing it out, they change jobs. And so, you know, you don't have that temptation to do that when you're, when you have an IRA. And it's actually very cumbersome to actually roll over a 401k as well. It takes time, there's paperwork. It's just, it doesn't make sense why that process is so slow. I have to imagine it's probably something that the fund companies have created to make it harder to move the assets from them.
Sure. If you have a, not to pick on one company, but if you have a Prudential 401k plan and you want to take a rollover, it's much, much easier to roll that to a Prudential IRA than to Fidelity or Charles Schwab or Vanguard.
Yeah. So it just becomes difficult again. So, and the temptation is there. So there needs to be also, I think, I mean, it's people's money. They should be able to do what they want with it, but there needs to be a higher hurdle for those people to think about and make that decision before they can move that money too, I think. Because that just, you're hitting the reset button every time you change jobs, basically, and starting from scratch.
So what if we weren't? What would it look like in a world where you didn't have to hit reset every time, that your retirement savings was more streamlined? Tell me what your ideal scenario looks like.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a perfect option, really, but I think that you need to make an option that will benefit the most people, because people are going to be able to poke holes in every scenario, or people always find caveats. But I think that the target date retirement funds was a good start. I think that the robo-advisors would be an even better option. And I think if those robo-advisors, because they've already shown that they can build the technology out and not charge enormous fees to their clients. And so I think if you have that robo-advisor platform that's able to scale to, again, small businesses or even larger companies, I think it's already set up so you have that third party that you're then be able to work with the companies and then stay with that Betterment or Wealthfront or any of those when you leave. I think that that is just a way easier way to do it. And also, you get some of the portfolio management stuff that you don't get elsewhere. I know a lot of the 401k provider try to provide education, and some of them do have some risk tolerance questionnaires and that sort of thing. But I think the robo-advisor is a really interesting route if they're able to get into that space.
I agree. I'll admit I am surprised at the apparent lack of interest on the part of the robo-advisors to get into this space. There's huge asset base there for them to access. And when you talk about low-hanging fruit and the opportunity to save costs from a traditional small business plan to, you know, an ETF-based fairly low-cost strategy as brought by a robo-advisor, I am really surprised. It would seem that they could package with a plan administrator to build out a platform that would in fact be very popular. And as an advisor to small business 401k plans, I wouldn't be too upset about losing business to something like that. Because the small business 401k space, it's so administratively burdensome to the business owner that it becomes very frustrating to try to walk through this with people and try to find a good solution for them.
Yeah, and I have been told that, so I wrote a piece a couple weeks ago about fixing the 401k, and I actually was contacted by a few different advisors, and that one of the hang-ups possibly is that the ERISA laws are making it difficult for the robo-advisors to get in. It's just sort of a lot of red tape to go through. So that could be part of it. But again, like you said, this I think is low-hanging fruit for them, and they have a constant stream of customers putting money in on a regular basis every month or every week or every 2 weeks. And yeah, you think that this is just a layup for them, that it would be, it just makes sense as long as they can prove that they can do it again. And they already have the technology built out, and I don't think the administrative costs of running that plan would be any, you know, much at all. So I agree.
Do you think that the advent of the current administration's idea behind the MyRA has any traction?
I don't really. I think if the government really wants to get involved, I think that the easiest thing for them to do would be to put the Thrift Retirement Savings Plan into place. It's actually probably the lowest cost retirement plan in the country, for sure, probably in the world. I have some family members in the government, and I've looked at the fund choices before, and again, it's not perfect, but they have these very simple fund choices, and they're all labeled with a letter, so you don't have these weird 10-word names, the
right.
Growth and income value series A. So it's very simple. It's very low cost. I think some of the funds are 2 to 3 basis points.
Right.
So that would be another step. Again, not a perfect solution, but they have a target date fund as well that puts them all together. But something that the government already does for their employees, it's an enormous plan that they could possibly potentially offer to small businesses or any business that wants just a simple plan to administer that doesn't take a lot of effort and it's low cost for their employees.
I completely agree. I'm not here to say that I think the government in all situations offers perfect solutions to many problems, but the Thrift Savings Plan, like you said, has expenses of a couple of basis points. Very simple fund choices, not overly complicated, and already has tremendous economies of scale. My immediate reaction to the announcement of the MyRA was, why do this at all? And why not simply open the Thrift Savings Plan to payroll contributions through the Treasury Department? It seems that the infrastructure is largely already there. And imagine being a small business owner with 20 employees and having the option to, one, establish your own 401k and choose if you're going to do safe harbor and choose if you're going to make profit sharing contributions and choose a vesting schedule for those and monitor your administrative costs and find a third party administrator and find a platform and find an advisor if to share the fiduciary liability, or simply allow your staff to opt into a pre-established plan from which you have essentially zero administrative costs, and maybe bring in an hourly advisor once a year to walk through the fund options and give feedback to staff. To me, that seems like a no-brainer.
I think the problem is that one of the problems is that the government already runs a Social Security program, and I don't think that they want to be seen as getting into people's entire retirement savings. But I believe it's run by, is it BlackRock or Barclays? One of the big companies runs it, and so I think you'd almost have to go through them. But yeah, it seems like, again, another pretty easy solution. And you could, like you said, you could offer it through the Treasury, but you could even do, you know, an IRA through this and just make it easy for everyone. And I think even the low costs, while I think they're important, they're not even the biggest benefit of the strategy. I think the biggest benefit is that it's just simple, because right. people say that they want choices, but when people are given 40 fund choices, they freeze up and don't know what to do. And I think just making things easier on people would do that. It also kind of brings up a different scenario for the government, and that one that I've wrote about too is sort of, and again, something that would never get off the ground, but forced retirement savings, kind of like they do in Australia.
Right.
I think they do 12% of salary actually is taken straight out of their paycheck, and it's worked wonderfully for them. But again, it's something that the majority of Americans would completely rebel against, I'm sure.
We do have a lot of problems with anything that smells like paternalism. And, you know, Richard Thaler has obviously discussed and done a lot of research here. The beginning of this is automatic enrollment. Now, there's essentially limitless research that says automatic enrollment is a win for everyone because people are lazy and like default choices. So when they're automatically enrolled, they keep contributing to their retirement savings. But if they're forced to opt in, they won't. This is true for 401ks. It's true for organ donation, a number of things. Now the question becomes, at what point do we become uncomfortable with this benevolent paternalism? And I go back to the small business owner who is establishing a 401k and has to decide, am I going to do automatic enrollment or not?
Yep.
And then they're forced to be in this position where they're saying, don't worry, staff, I decided for you to contribute to your 401k. And most small business owners that I know and work with aren't comfortable with that decision. So despite the fact that automatic enrollment is probably the right decision, it's not the one that gets made.
Right. Yeah. And you're right. And if people are, it depends how the decision is framed. If they have to opt out, it is hilarious that so many people don't do it. But if they're forced to opt in, then it's really hard to make that one step to opt in. So yeah, it's just a very simple, for the same decision, it's just a different way of looking at it. But again, I think something needs to be done. I actually was just working with a friend recently for a small business, and they must have some weird tax loopholes in the 401ks, but if you make above a certain amount in the company as far as the top quartile or top half or something,
yes,
it's possible for a small business to make you pay back taxes on your 401k contributions.
Right. What you're discussing is what are called highly compensated employees. And essentially, if you don't have what's called a safe harbor 401k plan, then there's testing to be done to find out how much of the total contributions that go into a 401k plan in any given year are from highly compensated employees versus the rest of the organization. And if there is imbalance there, as defined by the ERISA regulations, the money has to come back out.
Right. Well, yeah, this is something that I had never heard of before, so I did some looking into it for my friend, and I could not. So they have to actually pay back their 2013 taxes as well as the 2014 ones, which is just insane to me. that again, the company has that, you know, ability to do that to you. And again, I'm sure it's a case of them paying so much in costs for this that they've done the math and realize. But again, the employee is at a disadvantage again.
Right, because you're constrained by what other people in your organization are doing, which in and of itself doesn't make very much sense.
Right.
You know, getting back to, can the government provide a solution to this? I have a number of concerns about how this would be perceived. One is, if you look at the MyRA as an example of, you know, government involvement with, let's say, defined contribution retirement savings, the only option for investment in the plan is a treasury bond or a treasury bond like investment. Can't go down, you get 1 or 2% a year. And I can understand why they did that, which is, imagine that an uninformed investor is putting money into a retirement platform provided by the government and the stock market goes down, which, you know, it does from time to time. And suddenly people are asking questions about what the government has done with their money.
I agree. And it's possible that this plan, and again, it's for people who just have never saved before. So if it develops positive saving habits, I think maybe it will be a benefit to some people. But again, it's just a very tiny first step, I think. So they would have to figure out a way to graduate people after they've saved for a year or two into a legitimate retirement savings strategy, I think.
I agree. And, you know, I don't mean to pick on the MyRA. I know that when it was announced, there was a lot of talk in our industry about that this is, you know, not really worthwhile. But I think we forget that the target audience for the MyRA is, like you said, people who have never saved before, people who don't have an understanding of investments or finance and need an easy way to do something. And that's proven by the fact that the IRA has a $15,000 limit on how much money can actually be in there. So it's obviously not designed to be the end all for retirement savings. But in my perspective, it's an interesting case study to see how far the government is willing to be involved in this conversation.
Right. And I think the government's next step would probably be some sort of annuity, because like you said, they don't want to take the risk of people losing money. So I have to imagine that that would be their next step. They're going to keep it very simple and not very risky for the people that take part in it.
I agree. And I think for a lot of people, a buy your own pension model may actually make sense. They'd sacrifice compounded wealth over time. But at the same time, if it were presented to people in such a way that you said, you know, if you put 3% of your salary into this vehicle every year, you'll buy yourself a monthly pension in retirement of $200. And if you put in 6%, then you get $400. And if you put in 10%, then you get $800. I think such a situation might need to be orchestrated by the government, but not funded or insured.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And I mean, if you think about it, Social Security is the world's greatest annuity already. If they somehow tried to structure like that, which would probably be impossible to offer the same exact benefits, because we're seeing that it's very hard to keep it going in the same fashion, or it's going to be. But yeah, if you did something like that, you're right. Maybe people don't care about compound interest as much and building up their balance if they have in the back of their mind that they have a safe, stable income coming in that is not going to go away.
I agree. And we talk in our circles about how much people should have for retirement and will Social Security be there in the future, which for the record, I believe that it will be in some fashion for 99% of people. But for most retirees, there are a lot of people in this country who live on Social Security or maybe Social Security with a very small supplement. And if you could take the average married couple and say, okay, right now you're getting $25, $26, $2,700 a month from Social Security, and they could supplement that with a $800 essentially private pension payment that they were receiving as a result of buying pension credits from their payroll every week. That would go a really long way for people who had a mortgage paid off and otherwise could probably live pretty decently on $3,500 a month.
Right. Yeah. And I agree with what you said earlier too, that, the pension is looked at as the be-all, end-all retirement vehicle because we have this glorified view of everyone having them in the 50s and 60s. There actually was a congressional budgetary report done in 2009, I think, and they looked at the percentage of people receiving a pension age 65 or older going back to the late 60s, and that number is essentially unchanged since 1968, 1970, basically, which is fascinating. So I think that the majority of the people that receive a pension already are more or less just government employees.
Right.
So again, it was never the way, like you said, that everyone received a pension.
I'm not convinced people got gold watches either, but that's a whole nother.
Right. And the thing is that, you know, life expectancy has increased. So back in the day, retirement really wasn't as long as it is now. People didn't have to plan for people, you know, a lot of people worked until they didn't.
I think this is one thing that gets missed is that this is a relatively new construct, that we want to spend 20 to 30 years of our lives not working.
Right.
Certainly wasn't the case when Social Security was established. You know, Social Security was established, the retirement age was 65 and life expectancy was something like 66.
Yep.
It was a safety net. It wasn't a retirement plan.
Yeah, and, well, it's a good problem to have. Hey, we're living longer, but but it's a bad problem in that now we have to really manage our finances and make sure that, you know, one of the biggest risks for anyone is longevity risk. And so that means people have to work longer, have to save more money, a combination of both. But again, it's not a bad problem to have that people are living longer. They just can't expect things to work out exactly as they did in the past when people weren't living as long.
Right. We do have to pay for it somehow.
Yes, someone does, unfortunately. But yeah, but it's a good problem to have, I think.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of discussion that gets thrown around about, you know, do we have a retirement crisis, the $6.6 trillion shortfall? I'm not so convinced that this isn't a problem of our own creation in our own minds. Because number one, if you look at the nature of work in the United States, it's much less physically demanding. I could probably do what I do for a living until my mental faculties fail. I sit at a desk, stand sometimes, and I talk on the phone and email, and I look at Excel spreadsheets. I mean, that's sort of like the core of my day.
Right. Yeah, we're on a farm from 6 a.m. to sundown, basically.
Right. It's not exactly backbreaking work. And so maybe, as you alluded to, it's reasonable to expect someone like me to work until 70 or 75.
Yep, exactly. And the funny thing is I read these really scary retirement surveys every week, and they're always something along the lines of 50% of the people have no money saved. Maybe the rest have 10 grand, and then there's 10 or 20% that have six figures. And the numbers are always terrible. But I've yet to see, you know, these retired people with no money in a breadline yet.
If you see a breadline, you know, take a picture and give me a call. I haven't seen one for a while.
Right. So, and I'm sure people are struggling, but somehow people end up making do, and maybe it's not the retirement that they envisioned, and they're not living on an island somewhere. But you're right. Somehow, if it's just Social Security, they're making do somehow, and people obviously are able to adapt if they haven't saved, and if they haven't saved, then they maybe don't get the retirement that they wanted. But I don't think it's we definitely need people to save more. And again, I think the younger generation that's going to be living longer is definitely going to be more on their own. I agree with you that Social Security is still going to be around. Who knows how much of it we'll get. But I think that it's not as big of a problem as people make it out to be, and people will be fine in most cases.
Yeah, and I think we forget too, and Morgan Housel and I chatted about this some time ago, along with this retirement crisis, our standard of living is wildly better than it was 50 years ago. And for most people, we could probably live in retirement on Social Security at a standard of living comparable to 1960s standards. Now, we want a smartphone and an iPad and 2,500 square feet to live in and all these things. And it's good. And, you know, I'm a big fan of capitalism, raising standard of living. But I think sometimes we miss that for most of us, life is pretty comfortable in retirement. By global standards, wildly comfortable.
Yep. Yeah. It's all kind of a relative game, and it really has a lot to do with each individual's expectations and what their neighbor or their coworker or their family members are doing. And that's how people judge themselves sometimes. So yeah, it can be a relative game instead of an absolute game for a lot of people.
So before I let you go, give me your top three things that if you could implement today, you would do today to improve the retirement savings situation in this country. And I'll do the same.
Okay. First step would be, like you said, I think we have to have an opt-out strategy. We need to get people to save first and foremost. All the investment options, and again, the stuff that we argue on a daily basis. It would be nice to have a huge fund selection with different factor models and different options and low-cost funds, but first people have to be able to save. So I think that's the first step. Second step would be, I think that the robo-advisors need to get involved. And again, starting with the small business owners and put them together to keep their costs low and make it easier for their employees to build a diversified, low-cost portfolio and keep things fairly simple. And then third, I think people need to – one of the biggest problems is once people make that first choice, they make zero choices in the future. So right. They save 3% because that's what they're going to get on their match, and then they never change it, and they never change their fund choices. So I think the maintenance has to change, and I think that the Save More Tomorrow plan is a good one, where you bump up your savings every year when you get a raise, so you don't have that loss aversion of feeling like your salary is going down. You save 50-60% of your raise every year. And it automatically just goes into your retirement plan. So I think, yeah, getting to save is step one, making it easy, an easy plan for all involved. And I think the robo-advisors is a very good model, not a perfect one, but a good one. And I think that getting people to have that ongoing maintenance and follow up when their circumstances change, and saving more money is the third option.
Yeah, that's great. So my three would be, first, let's decouple employment and retirement savings to do two things. One, eliminate the disadvantage of those people who might work for a small business who don't have access to a 401k plan. And two, to eliminate the administrative burden of the employer and cost of providing that plan. I'm not sure what that looks like, whether that's access to the thrift savings plan for everyone who has a payroll, or if it's a choose your own 401k where Vanguard or Wealthfront can come out and say, we have a public 401k plan and everyone can participate, and here's where to send your direct deposit, and now you have access to it, and it's not tied to your employer, and you can take it with you to your next employer. I think, like you, my number two is more nudging, some more benevolent paternalism to force people to opt out, automatic enrollment, and like you, Save More Tomorrow, and let people establish what those ranges look like so that they can be auto-enrolled at 3 or 4%, and then it goes up, you know, 1% a year until they hit 10 or 12 or 15% or whatever that number looks like. I think the third piece for me is, I think we need to have more conversations and explore mandatory retirement savings. It's an uncomfortable conversation in this country. People don't generally like the idea. I think no one would notice. That's my immediate thought. You know, if it started the next time you took a new job, you would never know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, people would put up a big fuss at the beginning, and then maybe it just, yeah, kind of goes away.
And I think there are complex questions about, where does the money go? Do you have the option to buy an annuity? Do you have the option to invest on your own? Do you have the option to, you know, throw it all into essentially a government bond? I'm not sure exactly what that looks like, and I'll also plead ignorance about what's happening in other countries that are implementing mandatory retirement savings. But if we believe that this is, maybe crisis is a strong word, if we believe that this is a problem, we ought to be looking at how the problem's being solved around the world. I know we have a tendency to believe that as Americans we often have the best solution to everything, but I think maybe there are examples elsewhere that we should consider. And if this quote unquote $6.6 trillion shortfall is a real problem, which maybe it is, and maybe it's a little overblown, if you said everyone has to make a mandatory 3% contribution, that's a mandatory 3% match, that's essentially another version of payroll taxes, that would go a long way for a lot of people.
Yeah, and a tax that benefits a lot of people. Yeah, I think we both agree, though, that just things need to be made easier, because there are just so many plan options. I know my employer actually just went through getting a new administrator within the last 5 or 6 months. And it's amazing how many of them there are that you have to go through, and how different they are, and how different the costs are, and the fund structures. even for people on the investment side looking at this stuff, it's not easy to sort through all the differences. So I think it just needs to be made easier, and that would benefit 95% of the people.
I completely agree. I wish we had disagreed more, but Ben, I want to thank you for being part of Fireside Markets today. For listeners, there will be links to Ben's comments about fixing the 401k plan from Wealth Common Sense on the blog, as well as a few external links to things that we've mentioned here today. Thanks for listening, and I hope you join us again next time.
For additional information, details regarding references made in today's episode, or to subscribe or comment on this podcast, visit us online at basinasset.com.